This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, May 3rd. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We'll speak with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Sophie Mann Shafir of the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. CAI's Patrick Flannery will speak with our Statehouse correspondent Katie Lannan. And we'll hear from Colin Hogan at the New Bedford Light. Lots to get to. So here we go to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. The Cape Area Congressional Delegation is pressing the owner of the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station to answer questions about the evaporation of radioactive water from the plant. And they're giving the company a deadline to respond. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with that story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
So we know political leaders are starting to put more pressure on Pilgrim's owner, the company Holtec, to listen to the concerns of the community. What's happening in this latest step?
Well, the news this week is that three members of our congressional delegation sent a letter to Holtec with a pretty substantial list of questions they want answered in writing by the end of this month. As you said, they are focused on the evaporation of water from the nuclear reactor system and related areas of the plant. This letter is signed by Senators Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren and Representative Bill Keating. And the issue, of course, is that the water in the plant is contaminated. It contains radioactive material as well as other pollution. It does get filtered, but that filtration does not remove everything. And so this letter is looking for more details about what's happening there. The letter has 13 questions. Some of them are multi-part questions. So Holtec does have some work to do if they plan to reply to this. Some of these questions have been addressed verbally in some of the public meetings in the past, but certainly not all of them.
Well, what are some of the other questions that they're asking Holtec to respond to? There is quite a list here.
Yes. They want to know, for example, how fast the water is evaporating, because not only does that go to possible exposure to whatever's in the water, but it also puts a timeline on how fast public officials are going to have to move if they want to try to force Holtec to change what it is doing there at Pilgrim, for example, to ship the water to a disposal facility out of state. Another thing the letter asks is how the filtration that they're doing before this evaporation occurs would compare to the kind of water treatment that would happen if Holtec were to discharge the water into Cape Cod Bay, which is something the company has proposed doing. Markey, Warren, and Keating, again, in this letter, also asked the million-dollar question that all the activists have been asking and demanding, really, which is, would Holtec forego any further plans to discharge water into the bay or to intentionally evaporate it until after some kind of a full public review process?
Talk a little bit about how the political attention to this really has been building over the last few months.
Yes, this letter follows a letter in March from the entire state legislative delegation from Plymouth and the Cape and Islands, including the three members who are Republicans. And that group called on Holtec to stop the evaporation until the state could analyze how this type of evaporation was operating as a method of wastewater disposal. So even though the politicians that really have been working on this issue for a long time, for years, really, the pressure for action does seem to be building here. And in the background as well, behind all of these letters, everyone is still waiting to see what the State Department of Environmental Protection is going to do. That's because DEP still has not finalized a draft permit denial that they issued to Holtec last summer. That was for Holtec had applied for a permit modification to allow them to discharge the water into Cape Cod Bay. But until that a draft denial is finalized, that's still in a holding pattern, can't be challenged. And so, everyone's kind of waiting with bated breath at this point.
And again, this is it was more than 1 million gallons of water that Holtec has there that's contaminated with different kinds of contamination. And even what it is a question there. And it's already evaporated down to, we think, around 900,000 gallons. I know that you interviewed
less than 900. Yes.
Less than 900,000. Yeah. You interviewed a spokesman for Holtec about this letter from Markey, Warren, and Keating. How is the company planning to respond?
So far, Holtec is still deciding. They told me whether to reply to the letter at all. And that is according to Patrick O'Brien, who's the company spokesman that I interviewed. But as far as the big picture issue of whether they will stop evaporation while this whole thing plays out, he says no. Part of that is because there is some passive evaporation that happens on its own, just like would happen with any water or swimming pool or something like that. But the company did install submerged heaters that accelerated the evaporation over the winter. Holtec says that wasn't, you know, accelerating evaporation wasn't the purpose of the heaters. They were there for other reasons, and they're now shut off because of the warmer weather. But ultimately, O'Brien says, no, they do not have plans to stop the evaporation.
So this letter from the delegation to Holtec means that Holtec has this end of May deadline to respond. What happens if they don't respond or the company doesn't respond in a way that's any different from the past? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, I think people are waiting to see what the state and federal agencies are going to do next if Holtec doesn't respond in a way that, you know, they find more satisfying. Keating said the response could be one of several things. It could be state action based on the Ocean Sanctuaries Act, which is the law that was cited in that draft DEP decision I talked about a minute ago. There could be possible federal action, Keating says. And this issue could end up in court. Just last month, Holtec filed a lawsuit against the state of New York over a law that blocks discharge of radioactive material into the Hudson River. So then, you know, in Massachusetts, what would be next here? You have both sides kind of trying to wait it out and see who makes a move first. Keating didn't seem to know exactly what the next step would be. So everyone is kind of waiting to see who's going to make a move. And we at CAI, of course, are going to be watching all of that very closely.
Let's move on to another story that you reported this week about the development of a new terminal in New Bedford, where offshore wind companies will be able to store parts and equipment. It's expected to be a home base for maintenance jobs associated with offshore wind. Tell us about this.
Sure. This is the Foss Marine Terminal. It's on the New Bedford waterfront. And the planning for this project has been going on for a while. Demolition of old buildings on the property has happened. But now is the time when the construction of new infrastructure there is really getting underway. They're building a new pier there. The first of three deep water vessel berths is under construction right now. Those will be for the large ships that carry parts for the turbines, and they're used to actually, you know, service the turbines during operations. The terminal will also have 11 docking locations for smaller boats. Those would be things like crew transportation vessels and similar size boats. And eventually there will be warehouses there as well. None of that has been built yet, but the offshore wind companies would use the warehouses to store the parts and equipment. And the companies would be tenants, really, of the terminal. So they would use it when they needed it, and then, you know, they could move on because they don't own the terminal. But they would use it as a base. The offshore wind developers would use that location as a base for their day-to-day operations, their maintenance trips back and forth. They'd have employees coming in, going out to the wind farm for a certain amount of time and then coming back.
What's the timeline look like for all this work? When will it be ready?
Well, that first berth for a large ship is scheduled to be done in June. And the terminal president, Andrew Saunders, told me half of the terminal's operational capacity should be ready by this summer. Now, that does not necessarily mean that actual warehouses will be built on the property by summer. And that's because a lot of this work depends on agreements with the offshore wind companies, and those agreements are contingent upon the companies getting the contracts for their wind farms. As many of our listeners are aware, the state is running a bid process right now for contracts for offshore wind. So the companies are competing. And so the terminal will be coming online gradually. We'll be able to function with those boats going out, coming in, all of that. But some things will be built on sort of a temporary basis. And then the full build out of the terminal could happen, Saunders said, by 2029. That's if, if they have all the contracts they anticipate getting.
I want to turn to one more bit of offshore wind news of special interest to people on the Outer Cape that we heard about this week. We just have about a minute here. Tell us what's happening there.
Yes. So there's a set of new lease areas for offshore wind farms located off the Outer Cape. They're in the Gulf of Maine, which goes all the way from Nova Scotia down to Cape Cod. And so, in fact, six out of the eight lease areas that developers could lease are directly off the Outer Cape. Two of them are closer to Maine. But the federal government's going to be holding a number of meetings in May and June about these offshore wind areas. The lease areas start 25 miles off the Outer Cape, which is actually closer to mainland Cape Cod than Vineyard Wind. So we're going to be following this. And, certainly for listeners on the Outer Cape who are interested in offshore wind, now is really the time to tune in to this issue if you have not before.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
This is the news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll check in with CAI's Eve Zuckoff and then Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Stay with us. This is the news roundup on The Point. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Reactions are rolling in after the Massachusetts Army National Guard put forward a new plan to build a smaller machine gun range on Joint Base Cape Cod. CAI's Eve Zuckoff has been talking to folks and joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
First, remind us what the Guard is now proposing and why it's changed from what they put forward 4 years ago.
Sure. So the Massachusetts Army National Guard submitted a new plan to the Environmental Protection Agency because the agency found that the initial plan poses some real concerns to the aquifer that supplies us with basically all of our drinking water on the Upper Cape and possibly a lot of drinking water to the mid-Cape. So this new plan reduces the ammunition use from 1.3 million bullets per year if the range gets built to around 800,000. EPA officials weren't so pleased with that because it's still tripling the number of bullets fired on the base per year. And also the bullets would only be collected every 10 years or so. But the Guard also said that they'd eliminate the area of the range that would be needed to train with the 50 caliber machine gun, the biggest of guns. Instead, the eight lanes would only support the training of two smaller guns, among some others. These are two of the biggest changes among a slew of others that are just really designed to ease the EPA's beliefs that this machine gun range is just not safe for public health. It's been met with mixed results.
Well, we only know about this new proposal because members of our congressional delegation asked for an update from the EPA, who's been reviewing this. Now that the congressional delegation has gotten a chance to look at this, what are lawmakers saying?
Yeah, well, we got responses to this from Senator Ed Markey and Congressman Bill Keating. Markey said he's grateful for the EPA's work because, quote, when federal funds are being requested for a project and when that project could affect a resource as critical as the aquifer, we must let sound science be our guiding light. In its response to my letter, the EPA highlighted some clear and so far unaddressed concerns. So clearly, Senator Markey is taking seriously what the EPA is saying here. And then a spokesperson for Congressman Bill Keating, whose congressional district includes Cape Cod, shared a similar statement saying that he trusts the EPA is in the best position to determine whether or not, quote, any project changes will satisfy concerns about potential impacts to our sole source aquifer. And just more generally, he stands by his position that the EPA needs to be allowed to finish this review before the project moves forward, which has been a concern floating around. Like, could the Guard put shovels in the ground, before the EPA review is finished? There's a lot of pushback and there's money appropriated, but it's really not allowed at this point.
So you also talked with people who have been vocal critics of the proposed machine gun range. What did you hear from them about this new scaled down proposal?
Yeah, critics said a number of things, really got in the details here. So one of them told me that this project is inappropriate no matter how it's configured. Mark Forrest, our county commissioner, said that's true no matter how you scale or change or modify it. And it's interesting because Forrest back in 2002 was part of an effort by the state to protect 2/3 of the base as conservation land by establishing the Upper Cape Water Supply Reserve. And that designation came after part of the base was declared a Superfund site from past military contamination, and it allows military training above the aquifer as long as it's, quote, compatible, this is the key word, with wildlife preservation and water protection. This range, Forrest said, that requires clear-cutting 170 acres of trees and still threatens drinking water, is just not compatible. He said it's almost like someone's trying to build a school playground in the middle of a highway, and, you know, no matter how you want to propose it, it's just not appropriate.
That's quite a metaphor.
Yes.
The Guard also said that they would eliminate a proposed area of the gun range with extra long lanes where soldiers could shoot the 50 caliber M2 machine gun. You looked at this very closely. What this machine gun requires, this is firing a range about a mile. Is reducing the range satisfying to critics here who have been saying this is just too much?
There's a theme here, Steve. No. I talked with Andrew Gottlieb, the executive director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. He has been just a vocal critic of the range for a long time now. And he said, you know, by characterizing the project as a reduction in size, it completely contradicts the basis for which the Guard pursued the range in the first place, which is that they needed it as designed without changes in order to meet the Department of Defense training requirements. And now all of a sudden, he says, we're asked to believe there's a scaled down range that will also meet those training requirements. Like, it's actually really confusing. So he said, to kind of see how he interprets it, he's concerned that Guard officials are pursuing this scaled down range now with the money that they have in hand now, and that they fully intend to come back in the future and build their original scaled up plan. He said at the end of the day, you know, the project will get segmented and we will end up with the same project of the same size with the same impacts. And that is just, called it disingenuous.
Excuse me. Again, you've reached out to the Guard for comment. What did they say?
Yeah, no. We've sent them 10 questions about this new proposal last week. A spokesperson for the Guard declined to answer. Some of those questions are spelled out on our website, and I encourage people to check them out. And then I reached out saying, you know, here's this latest round of criticism, of feedback to this new proposal. Do you have a comment to that? And didn't get a response.
Really quickly, one of the reasons the Guard said they needed this is because these folks who need to be trained are right now going all the way up to Vermont.
Or New York.
So it's taking a lot of time, travel time, to go there. And so they needed a range right here on the Cape so they could do this. But with the scaled down range, they still have to travel elsewhere to do that training. Is that right?
Correct. From what I understand so far, that is correct. I would love to talk to the Guard about that more detailed. Yeah. Maybe there's something I'm missing, but I've read the reports. That's my interpretation. And meanwhile, there's another base, actually, just in central Mass, Fort Devens. A lot of people know it, that is also building an almost identical machine gun to the one that they machine gun range, excuse me, that they are now proposing for Joint Base Cape Cod. So without those two extra long lanes, it's going to look really similar to what's going on.
So the question is, why build one here if they're building one already in central Mass?
That's the question of critics, yes.
That is CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thank you for following all that.
Thank you.
Students at colleges and universities around the country have been protesting, calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Bringing that story closer to home, some of those students have connections to our region. The Martha's Vineyard Times spoke with a number of them, and Unki Sanu of the paper joins us with this story and more. Hi, Unki.
Hi, Steve.
You reached out to a number of recent grads from the Island High School to find out what their experience has been. Pick one of these and tell us what you heard.
Well, we'll start with one that's a bit closer to home in that case, since Columbia and UC Berkeley, those places have been kind of in the news a lot. We'll head to Northeastern. One of our reporters talked with Sophia Kokoska. She's a graduate of Martha's Vineyard Regional High School. And she was telling us about how the protests at Northeastern, you know, they started calm with, you know, the students with their signs calling for ceasefires and calling in their school to divest from money that would, that may be helping the war effort in Gaza for Israel. But she also told us that the tensions rose gradually with, you know, some police officers supervising them turning to a much larger number. And, you know, it's been reported quite broadly that a lot of students, maybe around 100, were arrested during the protest.
Another student that you spoke with is at American University in Washington. Tell us a little bit about what she told you.
Sure. Ava Dunbar McGee told us about how, you know, they're also doing the encampments at American University. And while that place doesn't have as much of what Northeastern was experiencing, Ava told us a little bit about how the campus, while it's overwhelmingly in support of the Free Palestine movements and whatnot, there is a division on the campus ground because it has a pretty big Jewish community on campus. So, you know, that kind of hits home for a lot of them in terms of the war that's going on in the Middle East. But also, she also told us about how there's been some not great and extreme forms of expression, and which at times become anti-Semitic from the Free Palestine supporters, but also, it's not all around high tensions with all the things going on.
Mm. It's an interesting kind of inside look into what's happening on some of these campuses to have it coming from some of these students who have recently graduated Martha's Vineyard High School there. Hey, Unki, before we let you go, I want to talk to you about today. It is a special day for the Martha's Vineyard Times. Tell us what's happening.
So today, on this day, May 3rd, 1984, the Martha's Vineyard Times issues their first paper. So, sounds like their birthday in a way.
Happy 40th birthday.
Happy 40th for the Times, indeed. So it's a special time. We are trying to get folks kind of aware about that, about the little birthday thing going on.
And you guys are taking a little look back at some of the reporting and what the journey has been like.
Yeah. For example, in our former owner of the paper, Doug Cabral, wrote an essay kind of looking back on the time that he's been with the paper and how the news landscape has kind of shifted since when the Gazette was the only paper around on the island. Now there's two papers for the Vineyard, and now there's a lot more that can be covered, and we're going to keep doing that.
It's a really neat essay by Doug Cabral there, because he traces the history of the paper as it came about, but also kind of goes back to talk about how the island towns sort of broke apart to each become their own town, that how Vineyard Haven separated out from Edgartown long, long ago. And there's a lot of history woven into all of this and why there's a different sense of voice for the different papers. And it's a great little essay. You can find that in the Martha's Vineyard Times. That's Unki Sanu. Unki, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Aquaculture is a big deal in Massachusetts and around Cape Cod. And you may not know this, Chatham is home to the largest wild commercial shell fishery in the state. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us to explain why this is a contentious topic. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, the town has recently been looking at creating private aquaculture grants, that is, giving shell fishermen a piece of the shoreline to farm on, which is what happens in most other towns around the Cape. But historically, that hasn't been Chatham's way. Is that right?
It hasn't. Chatham has exactly one private shellfish grant in the Oyster River. It's the Chatham Shellfish Company. They grow oysters there. And that's been in place for decades. But recently, the Shellfish Advisory Committee took up the idea of changing the town's shellfish regulations, which now prohibit any further grants for private aquaculture. They looked at changing that to allow some private grants, and they had quite a reaction from the shellfishing community, with I'd say a majority of the commercial shellfishermen in town opposing the idea. You know, and basically, the concept is that, you know, Chatham over the decades has had such a variety of shellfish in any particular shoreline area of town. Chatham's, as we know, Chatham's shoreline shifts a lot. Sand moves around, and with that comes productive shellfish grounds or non-productive shellfish grounds. You could have one area that's sort of fallow at one point, and there could be a big storm, and it would move stuff around. And a couple days later, or a couple weeks later, there could be a good set of quahogs or clams in that area. So, the current commercial shellfishermen were vehemently opposed to granting private grants. You know, they don't want to see privatization of any of the shellfish bottom in Chatham. But go ahead.
I think it's interesting that the Chatham's shellfish, commercial shellfish, shellfishermen, they're not focused solely on shellfish. For a lot of them, it sounds like this is part of a bigger picture of how they make a living on in that area.
Yeah, and this is the way it's been in Chatham for decades. You know, Chatham issued 220 commercial shellfishing permits last year, which actually that number has been sort of going down gradually over the past few years. But most of those people don't shellfish full time. A lot of them do, but many of them use shellfishing as a supplementary income. And a lot of them work in the commercial fisheries industry. You know, as it was explained at the meeting, you know, it may you may be a crew member on a commercial shellfishing vessel or a commercial fin fishing vessel. You know, you may not go out on a particular day because of weather or other factors. So you just go shellfishing and you can get, you know, a decent day's pay scratching on the flats in Chatham. So it's been a fallback for many, many people in Chatham for a long time. And that flexibility is something that shellfishermen are worried could be compromised if the town were to allow private shellfishing grants.
Looks like they've kind of decided to set this proposal aside for right now, the private shellfishing grants.
Yeah, the Shellfish Advisory Committee decided not to entertain any changes to the regulations at this time. Although, you know, they said if someone came up with a proposal for a private grant in an area, perhaps that is not a productive shellfishing area, the select board actually has the authority to waive that prohibition if they were convinced that that grant would not impact the wild shellfishery. And there is some support for that out there. You know, some shellfishermen cited the fact that there's not a lot of younger people coming into the commercial shellfishing industry. And, you know, being allowed a particular grant could encourage more people to do that. You know, as you said, Steve, a lot of other towns, particularly Wellfleet, it's mostly all grants and people pretty much own particular bottom and they can farm their shellfish there and that sort of guarantees them an income. So that is still an option, although I would say that that's probably not going to be, it would be a hard haul for someone to try to get that passed in Chatham.
It's Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Truro's double town meeting this weekend is widely expected to break Outer Cape records for attendance. How many people are expected? Sophie Mann Shafir of the Provincetown Independent is here with that prediction, along with details about what's going to make this one so big. Hi, Sophie.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
This is going to be held outside, and the town is setting up how many chairs? Tell us.
Upwards of 1,000, they're saying. It's going to take place under a heated tent.
That is a big number of turnout for a town meeting. More than 1,000 they're expecting, or at least 1,000. They're putting on 1,000 chairs under a giant tent. What are some of the issues? What is going on here that's really setting up this big expected big turnout?
So I think part of it is just purely anticipation. One of the meetings is annual town meeting, which typically happens around this time of year, and the other is the special town meeting that has been postponed since October. It was the fourth postponement that actually made it till May. So I think people are just really looking forward to it in terms of issues actually to be voted on and discussed. A key one is the Department of Public Works facility upgrade. Several of the articles on both warrants have to do with that. The town had initially proposed a $34.5 million facility that was close to 30,000 square feet. And there was just a lot of pushback to that proposal. People thought it was too big and too expensive, and there was a lot of just sort of rallying in town against that. In the 11th hour, the town appointed an ad hoc building committee, which came up with a sort of compromise proposal that's smaller, just over 20,000 square feet and $28.3 million, which is a kind of significant cost reduction. And those amendments will be made in real time on the floor of town meeting.
So the DPW project has drawn a lot of attention here and kind of been a stand-in for a lot of discussion about how big the town is getting and how and its spending. I'm going to ask you to back up just a little bit and explain why this is a double town meeting one more time, because there was a town meeting in the fall that never got held, right?
Yeah, exactly. So special town meeting was supposed to happen in October. And just beforehand, a voter registration campaign that was seen to threaten voter integrity surfaced, and with it, a spate of challenges against voter registration. So basically, in order to protect voter integrity, the town had to hold a series of hearings to make sure that the voter roll was clean. And so that explained the initial series of postponements. And then so many people showed up to the final date in the fall that the special town meeting was supposed to happen, that there actually was just a capacity issue. And then there was no place in the tiny town of Truro that could accommodate as many people as showed up, which explains why it's happening outside.
It looks like the weather should be okay for this. Is there a sense of how long this might all go on? When will it wrap up? Is it all going to be one long, long day here?
It's a great question, and I think a lot of people are wondering that. It's going to begin at 10 a.m., special town meeting first, and then a little recess, and then annual town meeting, and there's kind of no prediction as to when it will end, I think. The moderator has said it will go as long as it needs to in order for everything to be discussed, with the second day on Sunday likely to happen, or possibly going to happen. The tent will still be there. So it could be one or two very full days.
And there's a long list of articles that people can see at your website, provincetownindependent.org. Sophie Mann-Shafir, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. On Nantucket, town meeting is coming next Tuesday. And one more time, a big focus will be on what to do about short-term rentals. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror joins us with the details. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Every town meeting for a number of years now, it seems like, has brought a fraught discussion about short-term rentals on the island. This one has a new spin coming after a judge's ruling that really set some limitations on them. I guess, tell us what the articles are that town meeting will be taking up on this.
Right, there are two primary articles that town meeting will be taking up, Article 59 and Article 60. And Article 59, which is sponsored by Island Attorney Stephen Cohen, would explicitly allow short-term rentals as the primary use of a home, which directly counteracts the recent land court ruling you referenced that said that short-term renting is not legal as a primary use, but that short-term rentals can be an accessory use, and that ruling left that up to the town to define those differences. Those in favor of Article 59 say that the short-term rentals are an essential part of Nantucket's hospitality and tourism industry, that their existence provides hundreds, if not thousands, of local jobs, both directly and indirectly. and really keeps the status quo that has been in place on the island for decades of short-term rentals of homes across the island. Those opposed say that purely commercial short-term rentals, either by corporations or by single owners, are a detriment to local neighborhoods. They contribute to the island's lack of affordable housing and are a main contributor to density-related quality of life issues. One of the key battle lines being drawn over this article is the debate on just how permanent it would be and how strict it would be if passed. Town Council John Giorgio has said that it does still require compliance with the town's general bylaw on short-term rentals, and indicated that voters would have the ability to add superseding protections if it does pass to regulate short-term rentals, even if they are allowed everywhere on the island.
Mm-hmm. So that's one of the articles, which is essentially trying to move the baseline about whether short-term rentals are allowed as accessory or by right. There's another article as well, Article 60.
Article 60 is much simpler. It simply and essentially bans pure corporate ownership of short-term rentals, ownership by a company, not by an individual or a family. And there are a couple of other provisions in there as well that ban short-term rentals in affordable housing units and also restricts or prohibits timeshare type fractional ownership, which is something that actually came up last year. At least one property was being marketed in eighths. A single property was being sold to eight different buyers, and that is something that hasn't really been on the town's books before, and the town wanted to get a hold of that. They consider it a timeshare type situation, which is no longer allowed on the island, although there is a number of timeshares that are grandfathered at this point.
Those are the two big short-term rental articles here. But there's a whole lot more articles on the town meeting warrant.
There are 110 more other than those two. Voters are going to be asked to approve a $131 million municipal budget in addition to $42 million in capital spending for projects that range from increasing the landfill capacity to the reconstruction of the Jetties Beach tennis courts to a new fire department ladder truck and the purchase of the former Star of the Sea Youth Hostel in Surfside for seasonal employee housing. They're also going to be asked to authorize the creation of coastal resilience districts in which homeowners who would benefit the most from specific projects related to sea level rise would be responsible for providing shared funding through betterment taxes. That's probably what would have been the high point of town meeting if it hadn't been for the short-term rentals. That's going to generate a lot of debate as well, I think. The bulk of this year's citizen articles are non-binding, but are going to give town leaders a sense of the community's feeling on proposals that range from hiring a private investigator to look into the racist graffiti spray-painted on the African Meeting House in 2018, to reversing the good neighbor agreement that the town and Vineyard Wind's offshore energy project have.
Let me actually touch on that. An island group seeking to stop offshore wind development is hoping to take its case to the Supreme Court. You indicate that that could be a bit of a stretch.
It could be, and they're doing this because their attempts to stop or at least curtail Vineyard Wind were stymied in federal court, in a federal appeals court last week. They've said they want to take their fight all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, but again, only 1% of the roughly 8,000 cases that are petitioned to be heard by the Supreme Court are chosen each year, according to the Supreme Court's website. So they have a pretty high bar to get over. But the Act for Whales, which is the group, they've mounted a campaign for a couple of years now to stop the construction of the Vineyard Wind Project, which is the closest of the several wind projects in development or proposed south and west of Nantucket. The Vineyard Wind, which has already started building turbines, is about 14 miles southwest of the island.
That is Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Between investing in the state's emergency shelter system and pushing green energy, Governor Healey had a busy week addressing how it all affects jobs. Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery spoke with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon about these stories and more. Here's their conversation.
Katie, Governor Healey is calling on businesses to offer jobs to migrants living within the shelter system. And she says her administration can connect employers with residents looking for work. This comes, of course, as more money has been invested into the emergency shelter system. What's the latest with this?
Yeah, the governor also wrote this week to the U.S. Homeland Security Secretary, urging him to help expedite work permits so more migrants in the state's shelter system can get jobs here with local employers. That's something that was required of her under a law she signed this week that pours few hundreds of millions of dollars more to the state's shelter system to keep it from running out of money, to help it stay afloat. And as part of that law, there is also now a 9-month cap on shelter stays with some extensions possible. That cap will go into effect on June 1st. And that's something that state lawmakers say, at least the Democrats who backed this bill, Republicans opposed it, will help keep the program sustainable. Republicans say it's keeping the problem alive.
And it's not endless, though, is it, Katie? Really, it's got, another 60 days shelf life.
The money does recapitalize this. It'll keep the program running, and the families can continue to seek extensions in certain circumstances after their 9-month stays.
Okay. Governor Healey has been making the rounds this week. Let's talk about climate technology for a minute, Katie. What did the governor say about efforts on clean energy and green building?
The governor is pushing for the state to make a big $1 billion over 10-year investment in climate tech, in local companies that do things like work on decarbonizing steel or renewable energy technology. And she's pointing to a new study coming out this week from the UMass Donahue Institute that says there'll be a 12-to-1 return on investment from that kind of infusion of money into the system. So that's something that she's still pushing for. We're not clear quite yet if lawmakers are going to go along and approve that money, but that's something we're still watching up at the State House.
Well, speaking of green building, certain homeowners throughout the state will soon be able to take advantage of loans that are meant for making their homes more green. We're talking about solar panels and so on. So who qualifies for this, Katie, and how far will this money really stretch?
Yeah, this is targeting moderate to low-income homeowners, those earning less than 135% of the area median income, which ranges throughout the state. Over in Barnstable County, the limit's probably going to be around $150,000. But you can get a loan to do major home energy renovations that will reduce your home's energy usage through a climate bank that the governor launched last year. So that would help with projects like weatherization, roof repairs, putting in solar panels or heat pumps. And this is something that, you know, the Healey administration really hopes will help get Massachusetts to meet its climate goals and make it easier for homeowners to do so. They're providing the upfront costs here, so it would be a no cash down program.
Question for you here, Katie. Were you surprised when Governor Healey told business leaders this week that she has no plan to propose new taxes or raise existing taxes?
I was not surprised, because the message from Governor Healey has been pretty consistently that after she signed a tax break package last year, she's not looking to then turn around and undo that, even though there was criticism from progressives who said the state needs the money. We are in a budget crunch still, so that limits where the state can spend. It is a little interesting, though, that the governor is at the same time proposing to allow municipalities to raise their local room and meals taxes if they want to add a new surcharge on vehicle excise taxes, and to allow cities and towns that wish to do so to charge a new tax or fee on certain high-value home sales. I know that's something that a lot of communities on the Cape and Islands have been looking into. And, you know, the governor says that that's consistent because those aren't state taxes. They're just options that are available. She has been called out by the state Republican Party, who sees some hypocrisy between those positions.
All kinds of things coming out of the State House this week. Thank you so much, Katie Lannon, for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is CAI's Morning Edition host, Patrick Flannery, speaking with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. How does a vocational high school best serve its community? And what does a fair admissions process look like for VOTEC? New Bedford has been wrestling with these questions. Colin Hogan of the New Bedford Light has an update on what's already been a long and difficult discussion in the community. Hi, Colin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You start off your piece by describing a New Bedford VOTEC senior who set out herself to answer whether the school's admissions process is fair. Describe what are some of the questions and issues at the heart of this question.
Yeah, students, the community, as you said, have been talking about this for a while, and things have been changing. But the basic fact is that more students want to go to Greater New Bedford's VOTEC than there are seats. And students can apply from New Bedford, Fairhaven, and Dartmouth. And the policy has been changing because over the past few years, it's become clear that the students who are admitted are not representative of the sending communities. So you mentioned one student herself looked into this. And what's been happening is there's been a change from a ranking system to the school committee's been slowly trying out a qualified lottery where students have to meet certain thresholds. And if they do, they can be picked at random. But there's still some barrier to entry there. And this student and many others in the community are wondering, is this fair? And the most recent data has just come out, and disparities persist in those students who are admitted to the Greater New Bedford VocTech. They still aren't looking like the communities that they come from. But the superintendent has said he still needs more time, and he's not committing to any further changes.
So this has been going on for a while, like you say, and one of the things that they've been trying to, one of the tools they've been trying to use here to address the issue has been a lottery system for entry. Explain how that's been worked and why there's some question about whether it's doing what they want it to do.
Yeah, so this past year, half of the admitted students have come through the qualified lottery that I'd mentioned, and the other half of students are admitted through the old ranking system. The qualified lottery is sort of an experiment to see if a new admission system will work. But as I mentioned, there's still thresholds that students have to meet to enter into this new lottery. They have to meet some academic standards, some attendance, some disciplinary standards. And critics say that if a school is public and open to all, there should be no thresholds, that graduating the eighth grade is the only standard needed to enter into the ninth grade. So the new qualified lottery has not yet solved the disparities in admissions. It's an experiment that the school committee has been taking. And after this most recent data has become available, the superintendent of the Greater New Bedford VocTech said they'll continue to look at the data and think about new changes. But the qualified lottery has not had the effects that many hoped it would.
The mayor, New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell, has been pretty vocal about all of this, and he feels like the school has still not gone far enough to address the admissions disparity. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Mayor Mitchell has been talking about this publicly for several years now, and he's hoping that the VocTech school will make greater changes. The mayor is one of many folks who thinks that a lottery without any qualifications is the best way to admit students, that a random sample of students who would like to attend is the best way to sort out the issue of more students wanting to go than there are seats. The school has been a little hesitant to implement a random lottery. It wants to hang on to some of the metrics that let it sort out the caliber of students that enroll. But the mayor is among a number of voices, including state representatives in the area, Tony Cabral, who have said that that, in effect, is a discriminatory practice for public education.
Well, even just one of the metrics that people are kind of pointing out here is how many absences potential students have had, right? And the school's saying that if students have had a lot of absences, that shows that maybe they're not cut out for the workforce in a way that potential employers would need them to be.
That's absolutely one of the points that's been discussed a lot. And from the VocTech's perspective, they want students who are prepared for the workforce. That's their mission. What public school advocates, including Mayor Mitchell, have said is, you know, all students need to be prepared for the workforce, and the public education can't really discriminate based on that need for readiness. But the attendance metric is also one that the mayor has highlighted because it's more likely to affect low-income and homeless students who might miss school for a variety of reasons, taking care of siblings, not having the same access to school. Maybe they have jobs. So attendance has been one metric everyone's been looking at because it might be explanatory for why low-income students go to VocTech at lower rates.
We have to leave it there. It's Colin Hogan of the New Bedford Light, where you can read all about it. Colin, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff, Unki Sanu at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We spoke with Sophie Mann-Shafir at the Provincetown Independent, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, CAI's Patrick Flannery. He spoke with our Statehouse correspondent, Katie Lannan, and that was Colin Hogan of the New Bedford Light. Thanks to Amy Vince for engineering. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker.